open, bright with merchandised stands and shelves of all the current books. I didn't ask, I just looked. On a table in front of me, I spotted what I was searching for. Lion's Share. Maybe 50 copies, thick, bright blue, some stacked, some propped up. Lion's Share by Nicholas Jenks. My chest was exploding. I felt in the grip of unspeakable but undeniable right. A mission, a purpose. This was why I was an investigator. This very moment. I took a copy of Jenks's book and looked at the back cover. I was staring at the killer of the brides and grooms. I was sure of it. It was the cut of Nicholas Jenks's face, sharp as a stone's edge, that told me. The gray eyes, cold and sterile, controlling. And one more thing. The red beard, flecked with gray. Book 3. Redbeard. Chapter 70. Jill Bernhardt, the tough, savvy assistant district attorney assigned to the bride and groom case, kicked off her Ferragamos and curled her leg up on the leather chair behind her desk. She fixed her sharp blue eyes directly on my face. "Let me get this straight. You think the bride and groom killer is Nick Jenks?" she asked. "I'm sure of it," I said. Jill was dark, disarmingly attractive. Curly jet-black hair framed a narrow oval face. She was an achiever, 34, a rising star in Bennett Sinclair's office. All you needed to know about Jill was that as a third-year prosecutor, it was she who had tried the Lafrade case when the mayor's old law partner was indicted on a RICO charge for influence peddling. No one, including the DA himself, wanted to submarine his or her career by taking on the powerful fundraiser. Jill nailed him. Sent him away for 20 years. Got herself promoted to the office next to Big Ben himself. One by one, Raleigh and I laid out Nicholas Jenks's connections to the three double murders. The champagne found at the first scene, his involvement in Sparrow Ridge Vineyards, his volatile relationship with the third bride, Kathy Voskuhl. Jill threw back her head and laughed. "You want to bust this guy for messing up someone's life, be my guest. Go try the Examiner. Here, I'm afraid they make us do it with facts." I said, "We have him tied to three double murders, Jill." Her lips parted into a skeptical smile that read, "Sorry, some other time." "The champagne connection might fly if you had him nailed down, which you don't. The real estate partnership's a non-starter. None of it pins him directly to any of the crimes. A guy like Nicholas Jenks, public, connected, you don't go around making unsubstantiated accusations." With a sigh, she shifted a tower of briefs aside. "You want to take on the big fish, guys? Go back. Get yourself a stronger rod." My mouth dropped at her hard-edged reaction to our case. "This isn't exactly my first homicide, Jill." Her strong chin was set. "And this isn't exactly my first page one case." Then she smiled, softened. "Sorry," she said. "It's one of Bennett's favorite expressions. I must be spending too much time around the sharks." "We're talking about a multiple killer," Raleigh said, the frustration mounting in his eyes. Jill had that implacable prove-it-to-me resistance. I had worked with her on murder cases twice before, knew how tireless and prepared she was when she got to court. Once she'd invited me to go spinning with her during a trial I was a witness at. I gave up in a sweat after 30 grueling minutes, but Jill, pumping without pause, went on at a mad pace for the full 45. 2 years out of Stanford Law, she had married a rising young partner at one of the city's top venture firms, leapfrogged a squadron of career prosecutors to the DA's right hand. In a city of high achievers, Jill was the kind of girl for whom everything clicked. I passed her the security photo from the Hall of Fame, then Nicholas Jenks's photograph. She studied them, shrugged. "You know what an adversarial expert witness would do with these? It's pupshit. If the cops in Cleveland feel they can convict with this, be my guest." "I don't want to lose him to Cleveland," I said. "So come back to me with something I can take to Big Ben." "How about a search and seizure?" Raleigh suggested. "Maybe we can match up the champagne bottle from the first crime scene to the lot he purchased."
"I could run it by a judge," Jill mused. "There must be someone out there on the bench who thinks Jenks has done enough to bring down the structure of literary form to the point where they'd go for it." But I think you'd be making a mistake.
Why?
Some two-time crack whore. Her you can bring in on suspicion. You bring in Nicholas Jenks, you better arraign. You alert him that you're onto him. You'll spend more time fending off his lawyers and the press than making your case. If he's it, you're going to have one shot and one shot only to dig up what you need to convict. Right now, you need more.
Claire has a hair in her lab from the second killing, the DeGeorges, I said. We can make Jenks give us a sample of his beard.
She shook her head. With what you have, his compliance would be totally voluntary. Not to mention, if you're wrong, what you might lose.
You mean by narrowing the search?
I was talking politically. You know the game rules, Lindsay.
She riveted those intense blue eyes directly at me. I could envision the headlines turning the case back against us, like the screw-ups with O.J. Simpson and JonBenet Ramsey. In both cases, it seemed the cops were as much on trial as any possible defendants.
Jill got up, smoothed her navy skirt, then leaned on her desk. Look, if the guy's guilty, I'd like to tear him apart as much as you, but all you're bringing me is an unlucky preference in champagne and an eyewitness on her third vodka and tonic. Cleveland's at least got a prior relationship with one of the victims, bringing up a possible motive. But right now, none of the jurisdictions have enough to go on. I've got two of the biggest headline grabbers in 49er town looking over my every move, Jill finally admitted. You think the district attorney and the mayor want to pass this thing on?
Then she fixed unflappably on me.
What's the litmus test here? You're sure it's him, Lindsay?
He was linked to all three cases. The desperate voice of Christine Kogut was clear in my mind. I gave Jill my most convincing nod. He's the killer. She got up and made her way around the desk. With a half-smile, she said, I'm going to make you pay if this blows any chance of getting my memoirs in print by 40. Through the sarcasm, I saw a look flare up in Jill Bernhardt's eyes, the same resolute look I had seen when she was spinning. It hit me like a spray of mace.
Okay, Lindsay, let's make this case.
I didn't know what made Jill tick. Power? An urge to do right? Some manic drive to outperform? Whatever it was, I didn't think it was far from what had always burned through me. But listening to her cogently mapping out what we needed to indict, a tantalizing thought took hold of me. I thought about getting her together with Claire and Cindy.
Chapter 71.
At an old-fashioned steel desk in the dingy halls of the Chronicle's basement library, Cindy Thomas scrolled through 4-year-old articles on microfiche. It was late, after 8. Working alone in the underbelly of the building, she felt as if she were some isolated Egyptologist scraping the dust off long-buried hieroglyphic tablets. She now knew why it was referred to as the tombs. But she felt she was onto something. The dust was coming off secrets, and something worthwhile would soon be clear to her. February, March, 1996. The film shot by with indistinguishable speed. Someone famous, the Cleveland bride's friend had said. Cindy pushed the film onward. This was how stories were earned. Late nights and elbow grease. Earlier, she had called the public relations firm Kathy Kogut had worked for in San Francisco, Bright Star Media. News of their former staffer's death had reached them only that day. Cindy inquired about any feature films Bright Star might have had an association with. She was disappointed when she was told the firm didn't handle films. The Capitol, she was told, the Concert Palace, that was Kathy's account. Undeterred, Cindy plugged Bright Star's name into the Chronicle's data bank. Any subjects of articles, names, companies, reviews written in the past 10 years were recorded there. To her mild delight, the search came back with several live responses. It was assiduous work and discouraging. The articles covered a period of more than 5 years. That would tie in with the time Kathy was in San Francisco. Each article was on a different microfiche cassette. It required going back into the files, requisitioning, 3 items at a time. After 4 sets, the night librarian handed her the clipboard, saying, "Here, Thomas, it's all yours. Knock yourself out." It was 10:15. She hadn't heard a peep from anyone in over 2 hours, when she finally came upon something interesting. It was dated February 10, 1995. Arts Today section. For local band Sierra, new film taps into a hit. Cindy's eyes shut down the text, fast-forwarding to anything that stuck out. Plans for their album, an 8-city tour. Quotes from the lead singer. Sierra will perform the song at tomorrow night's bash at the Capitol to kick off release of the film Crossed Wire. Her heart stood still. She zoomed ahead to the following day's arts section. She consumed the article almost in a single suspended breath. Took over the Capitol. Chris Wilcox, the star, was there. A photo with a dishy actress. Bright star, other recording stars in attendance. Her eyes traveled over the three accompanying news photos. In tiny print underneath each shot, she noticed the photographer's name. Photography by Sal Esposito, property of the Chronicle. Photography. Cindy jumped out of her seat at the microfiche desk and hurried back through the musty 10-foot-high stacks of bundled yellowing editions. On the other side of the tombs was the Chronicle's photography morgue, rows and rows of unused shots. She had never even been in here, didn't know how it was laid out. Creepy, creepy place, especially this late at night. In a flash, she recognized that the aisles were chronological. She followed the signs at the end of each aisle until she found February 1995. She ran her eyes along the outside of the stacked plastic bins, dated the 10th. When she spotted it, it was on the highest shelf. Where else? She stepped up on the lower shelf on her tiptoes and wiggled the bin down. On the dusty floor, Cindy frantically leafed through folders bunched up in elastic. As if in a dream, she came upon a folder marked in large black letters, Crossed Wire Opening, Esposito. This was it. Inside were four contact sheets, several black and white glossies. Someone, probably the reporter, had written the names of each person in pen at the bottom of each shot. Her eyes froze as she came upon the photo she was hoping for. Four people toasting the camera with arms locked. She recognized Kathy Kogut's face from the photos Lindsay had come back with. Red hair, curly, trendy inlaid glasses. And next to her, smiling into the camera, was another face Cindy knew. It took her breath away. Her fingers trembled with the realization that she had deciphered the hieroglyphics at last. It was the trimmed, reddish-colored beard, the narrow, complicit smile. As if he knew where all this might one day lead. Next to Kathy Kogut was the novelist Nicholas Jenks. Chapter 72. I was totally surprised when Cindy appeared at my door at 11:30. With a look of wide-eyed elation and pride, she blurted, "I know who Kathy Kogut's lover was!" "Nicholas Jenks," I replied. "Come on in, Cindy." "Down, Martha." She was tugging at my Giants nightshirt. "Oh, God," she groaned loudly. "I was so pumped up. I thought I had found it." She had found it. She had beaten McBride and Seattle, two squads of trained investigators as well as the FBI. I looked at her with genuine admiration. "How?" Too restless to sit, Cindy stalked around my living room as she took me through the steps of her amazing discovery. She unfolded a copy of the news photo showing Jenks and Kathy Kogut at the movie opening. I watched her circle the couch, trying to keep up with herself. Bright star, Sierra, Crossed Wire. She was hyper. "I'm a good reporter, Lindsay," she said. "I know you are," I smiled at her. "You just can't write about it." Cindy stopped, the sudden realization of what she had overlooked hitting her like a pie in the face. "Oh, God," she moaned. "That's like being in a shower with Brad Pitt, but you can't touch." She looked at me, half smiling, half like nails were being driven into her heart. "Cindy," I reached out and held her, "you wouldn't have even known to look for him if I hadn't clued you in on Cleveland." I went to the kitchen. "You want some tea?" I called out. She collapsed on the couch and let out another wail. "I want a beer. No, not beer. Bourbon." I pointed to my small bar near the terrace. In a few moments we sat down. Me with my nocturnal seasonings, Cindy with a stiff glass of wild turkey, Martha comfortable at our feet. "I'm proud of you, Cindy," I told her. "You did crack the name. You scooped two police forces. When this is over, I'm going to make sure you get a special mention in the press." "I am the press," Cindy exclaimed, forcing herself to smile. And what do you mean, when this is over? You have him.
Not quite, I shook my head. I explained that everything we had, even stuff she didn't know, the vineyard, the champagne, was circumstantial. We couldn't even force him to submit a hair.
So what do we need to do?
Tie Nicholas Jenks solidly in to the first crime.
Suddenly she began pleading. I have to run with it, Lindsay.
No, I insisted. No one knows, only Roth and Raleigh. And one more.
Who?
Cindy blinked. Jill Bernhardt.
The assistant district attorney? That office is like a colander trying to sail across the Pacific. It's nothing but leaks.
Not Jill, I promised. She won't leak this.
How can you be so sure?
Because Jill Bernhardt wants to nail this guy as much as we do, I said with conviction.
That's all? Groaned Cindy.
I sipped a soothing mouthful of tea, met her eyes. And because I invited her into our group. Chapter 73. The following day we met after work for a drink at Susie's. It was Jill's introduction to our group. All day I couldn't fix on anything other than the thought of confronting Jenks with what we knew and bringing him in. I wanted to accelerate everything, a face-to-face confrontation. I wanted to let him know we had him. Goddamn Redbeard! As we waited for drinks, I threw out a couple of new developments. A search of Kathy Kogut's home in Seattle had uncovered Jenks's name and phone number in the dead bride's phone book. A trace by Northwest Bell had turned up 3 calls to him in the past month, including one 3 days before the Cleveland wedding. It confirmed what Merrill Shortley had told us.
Right up to the very end, said Claire. Creepy. Both of them, actually.
We had run Jenks's photo by Marianne Perkins of Saks as part of a photo spread with 5 others. We desperately needed something that pinned him to the first crime. She paused over his likeness for a few seconds. It's him, she declared. Then she paused. But then, it's hard to tell. It was so quick. And far away. The thought of a defense attorney cross-examining her didn't sit well with me. It didn't surprise me that Jill agreed. It took no longer than a single margarita for her to make a seamless entry into our group. Claire had met her a few times when she testified at trials. They had developed a mutual respect for each other's rise through their male-dominated departments. We asked Jill about herself, and she told us she was Stanford Law and her father was a corporate attorney back in Dallas. No interest in the corporate thing. That was for her husband, Steve, who was running a venture fund for Bank America. They lived in Burlingame, affluent, exclusive, took rock-climbing treks in the desert at Moab. No kids. It just doesn't fit right now, she said. Jill seemed to live the epitome of the fast, successful life. At the same time, there seemed to be something missing. Maybe she was tired from the grind, the pace of her accomplishments. When our drinks arrived, Claire and I toasted Cindy's ingenuity in coming up with Jenks's name in such short time, and beating 2 police departments to the punch. Claire raised a glass to her.
You're pretty good for a rookie, of course, but you're still not the king, she smiled at me.
So, I'm thinking, Jill said, looking around the table. I know I can hold my own at dinner parties and all, but that's not why you asked me in, is it? Seems like we have all the angles covered here. The press, the force, medical examiner. Just what kind of a group is this?
I answered, since it was I who had invited her in. Women, climbing the ladder in their careers, law enforcement.
Yeah, with soft pushover types for bosses, put in Cindy.
Well, I qualify there, said Jill, and it doesn't hurt that each of you seems to have some connection with the bride and groom case. I held my breath. Jill could blow this whole thing if she wanted to, but she was here.
We have been sort of working together, I admitted, outside the investigation. Over margaritas, I explained how we had originally gotten together, how we had come upon this case, trying to solve it, sharing what we knew freelance, how it had become a sort of bond, how things had just gotten a bit deeper. Jill arched her eyebrows. I assume you're sharing all this with the investigation?
Of course, I insisted. Well, sort of. I told her how we were giving Cindy only what the department was about to release to the press at large, how there was a thrill in cutting through the departments, advancing the case. I know it's a different game when everything starts to get legal, I said. If any of this makes you uncomfortable... We were all sort of hanging there, awaiting her response. Loretta came and we ordered another round. We were still hanging, waiting on Jill. How about I let you know when things start to get uncomfortable, Jill said. She widened her blue eyes. In the meantime, you're going to need a lot stronger corroboration if we want to take this thing to court. The three of us breathed a sigh of relief. We tilted our near-empty glasses toward our new member. So, this outfit have a name? Jill inquired. We looked around, shrugged, shook our heads. We're sort of a murder club, I said. Lindsay's deputized us, Claire grinned. The Margarita Posse, Jill threw out. That has possibilities. Badass bitches, Claire giggled. One day we're all going to be running things, Cindy said. Homicide chicks, she came back with a satisfied grin. That's who we are. That's what we do.
Just shut me up if I start to roar, said Jill.
We looked around the table. We were bright, attractive, take-no-shit women. We were going to run things. Someday. The waitress brought our drinks. We raised four glasses toward one another. To us. Chapter 74. I was driving home, really pleased at having brought Jill into the group. But it didn't take long for the thought to worm its way in that I was still withholding from my friends. My beeper sounded.
What are you doing? Raleigh asked when I buzzed him back.
I was headed home. Beat.
You up for talking just a little? I'm at Mahoney's.
Mahoney's was a dark, crowded bar near the hall that was usually thick with off-duty cops. Already ate, I told him.
Meet me anyway, Raleigh said. It's about the case.
I was only a few minutes away. Mahoney's was on Brannan. To get to Potrero, I had to go right by it. I found myself a little nervous again. I was scared we were no longer playing things by the book. The book was, partners didn't get involved. Nor people with their lives ebbing away. I knew that if I let things go, anything could happen. This wasn't some casual fling we could go at for a night and try to rationalize away the next day. As much as I wanted him, I was holding back. Scared to let it all come out, of letting myself go, of dragging him in. I was relieved when I saw Raleigh waiting for me outside the bar. He came up to my car. I couldn't help noticing that he looked good, as usual. Thanks for not making me go in, I said. He leaned on the edge of my open window.
I looked into Nicholas Jenks, he said.
And? The guy's 48, went to law school but never finished, started writing novels his first year, wrote two books that didn't go anywhere, then this twisted thriller, Crossed Wire, hit. There's something you should know. Maybe 7 years ago, give or take a few, cops were called out to his home in a domestic dispute. Who made the call?
His wife. His first wife.
Raleigh leaned in closer. I pulled up the report. First on the scene, described her as pretty beat up, bruises up and down her arms, large bruise on her face. A thought flashed in my head. Merrill Shortley, on Kathy's boyfriend, he was into intense sex games. Did the wife file? I asked. Chris shook his head. That's as far as it went. Never pressed charges. Since then, he's cashed in big time. 6 huge bestsellers, movies, screenplays. New wife, too. That means there's an old one out there who might be willing to talk. He had a satisfied expression on his face.
So, can I buy you a meal, Lindsay?
A hot bead of sweat burned a slow path down my neck. I didn't know whether to get out or stay in. I thought, if I got out... Chris, I already ate, had a commitment.
Jacoby, he grinned.
He could always get me with that smile of his. It was sort of a women's thing. A group of us. We meet once a month, go over our lives. You know, nanny problems, personal trainers, country homes, affairs, things like that.
Anyone I know?
Raleigh raised his eyebrows. Maybe one day I'll introduce you. We
We sort of hung there, my blood slowly throbbing in my chest. The hair on Raleigh's forearm gently grazed against mine. This was driving me insane. I had to say something. "Why'd you call me out here, Chris?"
"Jenks," he replied. "I didn't tell you everything. We ran a firearms check on him with Sacramento."
He looked at me with a glint in his eye. He's got several registered.
"A Browning 22 caliber hunting rifle, a Renfield 30-30, a Remington 40.5.
He was leading me on. I knew he had struck pay dirt. "There's also a Glock Special, Lindsay. 1990 issue. 9mm. A rush of validation shot through my veins. Chris frowned. "He has the weapon of choice, Lindsay. We've got to find that gun." I made a fist and brought it down against Raleigh's in triumph. My mind was racing. Sparrow Ridge, the phone calls, now a Glock Special. It was all still circumstantial, but it was falling into place.
"What are you doing tomorrow, Raleigh?" I asked with a smile. "Wide open. Why?"
"I think it's time we talk to this guy, face to face."
Chapter 75. High on the cliffs above the Golden Gate Bridge, 20 El Camino del Mar was a stucco Spanish-style home with an iron gate guarding the terracotta driveway. Redbeard lived here. Nicholas Jenks. Jenks's home was low, stately, surrounded by decoratively trimmed hedges and bright blossoming azaleas. In the driveway's circle there was a large iron sculpture, Botero's Madonna and Child.
"Fiction must be good,"
Raleigh let out a whistle as we stepped up to the front door.
We had made an appointment through Jenks's personal assistant to meet him at noon. I had been warned by Sam Roth not to come on too hard.
A pleasant housekeeper greeted us at the door and took us back to a spacious sunroom, informing us that Mr. Jenks would be down in a short while. The lavish room seemed straight out of some designer magazine, with rich jacquard wallpaper, oriental chairs, a mahogany coffee table, shelves of mementos and photographs. It opened onto a fieldstone patio overlooking the Pacific. I had lived in San Francisco all my life, but never knew you could come home every night to this kind of spectacular view. While we waited, I examined photos arranged on a side table. Jenks, with a series of well-known faces. Michael Douglas, the top guy from Disney. Bill Walsh from the 49ers. Others were with an attractive woman I took to be his new wife. Sunny, smiling, strawberry blonde hair, in various exotic locations, beaches, skiing, a Mediterranean isle. In a silver frame there was a 4x6 of the two of them in the center of an enormous lit-up rotunda, the dome of the Palace of Fine Arts. It was a wedding photo. It was then that Nicholas Jenks walked in. I recognized him immediately from his photographs. He was slighter than I had imagined. Trim, well-built, no more than 5'10", wearing an open white dress shirt over well-worn jeans. My eyes were drawn immediately to the reddish, gray-flecked beard. "Redbeard, it's good to meet you, finally."
"Sorry to put you off, inspectors," he said with an easy smile, "but I'm afraid I get cranky if I can't get my morning pages in."
He held out his hand, noticing the photograph I was still holding.
"A bit like the set of Marriage of Figaro, wasn't it? Myself, I would have gone for a small civil ceremony, but Chessie said if she could snare me in a tux, she'd never, ever doubt my commitment to her."
I wasn't interested in being charmed by this man, but he was handsome and immediately in control. I could see what some women found attractive about him. He motioned us to the couch.
"We were hoping," I said, "to ask you a few questions."
"About the bride and groom killings," my assistant advised me. "Crazy. Terrible. But these acts, so incredibly desperate, cry out for at least a small measure of sympathy."
"For the victims," I said, placing his wedding photograph back on the table.
"Everyone always goes to the plight of the victims," Jenks said. "But it's what's inside the killer's head that puts cash in the account. Most people figure these acts are simply about revenge, the sickest kind of revenge, or even subjugation, like most rapes. But I'm not so sure." "What's your theory, Mr. Jenks?" Chris asked.
He made it sound as if he were a fan. Jenks held out a pitcher of iced tea. Something to drink? I know it's a hot one, though I've been holed up in the study since 8.
We shook our heads. I took a manila folder out of my bag and placed it on my lap. I remembered Cheery's admonition.
Keep it light. Jenks is a VIP. You're not.
Nicholas Jenks poured himself a tall glass of tea and went on.
From what I've read, these killings appear to be a form of rape.
Rape of innocence.
The killer is acting in a way that no one can forgive. In the most sacred setting of our society. To me, these killings are the ultimate act of purification.
Unfortunately, Mr. Jenks, I said, ignoring his bullshit, we didn't come up here seeking your professional advice. I have some questions related to these killings we'd like to run by you.
Jenks sat back in his chair. He looked surprised.
You make that sound awfully official.
That's entirely up to you, I said. I took out a portable cassette tape player from my bag. You mind if I turn this on? He stared at me, his eyes shifting suspiciously. Then he waved his hand as if it were of no concern.
So, where I'd like to start, Mr. Jenks, is these killings. Do you have any specific knowledge of any of the crimes, other than what you've read in the papers?
Knowledge?
Jenks took a breath, nominally reflecting. Then he shook his head.
No, none at all.
You read there was a third killing? Last week, in Cleveland.
I did see that. I read 5 or 6 papers every day.
And did you also read who the victims were?
From Seattle, weren't they?
One of them, I remember, was some kind of concert promoter. The groom, I nodded. James Voskul. The bride actually lived for a while in town, here. Her maiden name was Kathy Kogut. Do either of those names mean anything to you?
No. Should they?
So you never met either of them? Any interest you had in this case was just like anyone's?
Morbid curiosity?
He fixed his eyes on me.
That's right. Morbid curiosity's my business.
I opened my manila folder and took out the top photo. He was playing us, just as he had been playing us by leaving dead-ending clues along the way. I slid the photo across the table.
This might sharpen your memory, I said. That's Kathy Kogut, the bride who was murdered the other night. The man next to her, I believe, is you.
Chapter 76.
Slowly, Redbeard picked up the photo and stared at it.
It is me, he declared. But the lady, though quite beautiful, I don't recognize. If I can ask, where's this picture from?
The San Francisco opening of Crossed Wire.
Ah,
he sighed, as if that classified something for him. I watched the gears in his brain start to shift for the right response. He was definitely smart and a pretty good actor.
I meet a lot of people at these events. It's why I try to avoid them. You say this was that girl who was killed in Cleveland?
We were hoping this was someone you might have remembered, I replied. Jenks shook his head.
Too many fans, not much appetite to meet them, even the really pretty ones, Inspector.
The price of fame, I imagine. I took the photo back, thumbed it for a moment, then slid it back in front of him. Nevertheless, I have to come back to this particular fan. I'm curious why she doesn't stick out for you. From all those other fans. I withdrew a copy of a Northwest Bell phone bill from my folder and handed it to him. On it were several highlighted calls. This is your private number? Jenks held the copy of the bill, his eyes dimmed.
It is.
She called you, Mr. Jenks, 3 times in just the past few weeks. Once. Here, I circled it for you for 12 minutes, only last week. 3 days before she was married, then killed. Jenks blinked. Then he picked up the photo again. This time he was different, somber, apologetic.
Truth is, Inspector,
he took a breath and said, I was so sorry to hear what had taken place.
She seemed, in the last month, so full of anticipation, hope. I was wrong to mislead you. It was foolish. I did know Kathy. I met her the night of the photo there. Sometimes my fans are rather impressionable and attractive. At times I, to my detriment, can be an impressionable man.
I wanted to lunge across the table and rip Nicholas Jenks's impressionable face off. I was certain he was responsible for 6 vicious murders. Now he was mocking us and the victims. God damn him!
So you're admitting, Raleigh interjected, that you did have a relationship with this woman? Not in the way you're insinuating, Jenks replied. Kathy was a woman who hoped to satisfy her own vague artistic aspirations through an association with someone engaged in the act of creating. She wanted to write herself. It's not exactly brain surgery, but I guess if it was so damn easy, we'd all have a book on the bestseller list, right?
Neither of us responded.
We spoke, maybe met a few times over a few years. It never went beyond that. That's the truth.
Sort of mentoring, Raleigh suggested.
Yes, that's right. Good choice of words.
By any chance, I leaned forward, no longer able to control my tone, were you mentoring Kathy in Cleveland last Saturday, the night she was killed? Jenks's face turned granite-like.
That's ridiculous. What an inappropriate thing to say.
I reached into the folder one more time, this time taking out a copy of the security photo of the killer arriving at the Hall of Fame. This is a security photo from the night she was killed. Is that you, Mr. Jenks? Jenks didn't even blink.
It might be, Inspector, if I had been there, which I categorically was not.
Where were you last Saturday night?
Just so I understand, he said stonily, are you suggesting I'm a suspect in these crimes?
Kathy Kogut talked, Mr. Jenks. I glared at him. To her sister, to her friends. We know how you treated her. We know she left the Bay Area to try to get away from your domination. We know things were going on between you right up to the wedding night. I wouldn't take my eyes off Jenks. There was nothing in the room but him and me.
I wasn't in Cleveland, he said. I was right here that night.
I ran the whole body of evidence by him. From the bottle of Clos du Mesnil left behind at the Hyatt, to his involvement in the real estate trust that owned Sparrow Ridge Vineyards, to the fact that 2 of the murders had been committed with 9mm guns, and according to the state, he owned one. He laughed at me.
This is not what you're basing your assumptions on, I hope. I got that champagne ages ago, he shrugged. I don't even recall where it is. You can locate it, I assume, Raleigh asked, then explained that it was a sign of respect that we were asking him to turn it over voluntarily.
Would you mind supplying us with a hair sample from your beard? I asked.
What?
His eyes met mine with a churlish defiance. I imagined the look Melanie Brandt might have seen as he attacked her. What Kathy Kogut saw as he raised his gun to her head.
I think, Nicholas Jenks finally answered, that this fascinating interview has come to an end.
He held out his wrists.
Unless you're intent on taking me away, my lunch is waiting.
I nodded. We'll need to follow up on your whereabouts and on the gun.
Of course, Jenks said, standing up. And should you need any further cooperation, feel free to request it through my attorney.
I assembled the photographs and put them back into the folder. Raleigh and I got up. At that moment, the attractive strawberry blonde from the photographs walked into the room. She was undeniably pretty, with gentle aquamarine eyes, a pale complexion, long, free-flowing hair. She had a tall dancer's body and was dressed in thigh-length leggings and a Nike t-shirt.
Chessie! Jenks exclaimed. These are officers from the San Francisco Police Department. My wife, inspectors.
Sorry, Nikki, Chessie Jenks apologized. Susan's coming over. I didn't know you had guests.
They were just leaving.
We nodded stiffly, moved toward the door. If you could locate what we talked about, I said to him, we'll send someone by to pick it up. He gazed right through me. I hated to leave without taking him in and to have treated him with kid gloves, but we were still a few steps away from an arrest. So, Chessie Jenks smiled and said, has my husband finally gone homicidal? She went up to Jenks, clasped his arm in a teasing way. I always told him with those creepy crawler characters he writes about it was inevitable. Could she know? I wondered. She lived with him, slept with him. How could she not be aware of what was going on inside his head? I truly hope not, Miss Jenks, was all I said. Chapter 77. What did she mean by that? Chessie Jenks asked her husband, confused, after the police inspectors left the house. Jenks brushed her away. He paced over to the large French doors leading out to the Pacific. Idiots, he muttered. Amateurs. Who the hell do they think they're dealing with? He felt a prickly, stabbing heat racing over his shoulders and back. They were stupid, tiny-minded. Beetles. That's why they were cops. If they had any brains, they'd be doing what he was doing, living high over the Pacific. That's why they dig landfills, he replied distractedly. A place for cops to feel at home. Chessie picked up the wedding photo from the coffee table and set it back in its rightful spot. What did you do now, Nick? Why did she always drive him to this? Why did she always need to know? She came over, looked at him with those lucid, patient eyes. As always, his anger leaped up in a flash. He didn't even realize he had hit her. It was just that suddenly his hand hurt, and Chessie was sprawled on the floor, and the bamboo table on which the pictures were had toppled over, and she was holding her mouth. He shouted, "Don't you know when to keep away from me? What do you need, a road map?" "Uh-uh, Nick," Chessie said. "Not here. Not now." "Not here what?" he was shouting. He knew he was shouting, losing control, that the staff might hear. "Please, Nick," Chessie said, pulling herself off the floor. "Susan will be here soon. We're going to lunch." It was the notion that Chessie thought she could just sit there and judge him that really set him off. Didn't she see who she really was? Just some blonde with freckles he had picked out of a cattle call and turned into God's gift to Martha Stewart. He grabbed her by the arm and put his face inches from her beautiful, terrified eyes. "Say it!" The arm he held was trembling. A tiny stream of mucus ran out of her nose. "Jesus, Nick." That's what he liked, her fear of him, even though she never showed it in public.
"I said, say it, Chessie."
He twisted her arm behind her back. She was breathing heavily now, sweat forming under her T-shirt. Her little tits poked through. When she glared back at him with her paltry defiance, he twisted harder, digging his fingers into her arm. He shoved her toward the bedroom, her bare feet stumbling along. In the bedroom, he kicked the door shut. Who did the lead cop think she was, coming in here, accusing him like that? In her cheap Gap ensemble? What a fucking insolent bitch. He dragged Chessie into the clothes closet. Hers. It was dark in there. Only the dark and her sobs and the pervasive smell of her perfume. He pushed her forward against the wall, rubbed himself against her buttocks. He pulled Chessie's gym shorts down, her panties along with them.
Please, she cried. Nicky?
He found the familiar place where her small cheeks parted. He was very hard, and he pushed himself in deep. He was driving himself inside Chessie.
"Say it," he gasped. "You know how to make it stop. Say it."
"Rough,"
she finally murmured in a tiny whisper. Now she was loving it, as she always did. It wasn't bad. It was good. They all ended up wanting and loving it. He always picked them so well.
"Rough," she whimpered. "Rough, rough. Is that what you want, Nick?"
Yes, that was part of what he needed. It was all he expected from Chessie.
"You love it, Chessie," he whispered back. "That's why you're here." Chapter 78. We kept a close watch on Jenks's movements with a surveillance team of three cars. If he made a move to dump the gun, we'd know. If he moved to kill again, we hoped we could stop him. No matter how clever he was, I didn't see how he could execute another murder right now. I wanted to speak with someone who knew him, who might be willing to talk. Raleigh had mentioned an ex-wife, a history of violence between them. I needed to talk with her. It wasn't hard to track down Joanna Jenks, now Joanna Wade. A search through the police files had her maiden name listed as part of the domestic complaint she had filed against her husband years before. A Joanna Wade was currently residing at 1115 Filbert Street on Russian Hill. It was an attractive limestone townhouse on the steepest part of the hill. I buzzed, identified myself to the housekeeper, who answered. She informed me that Ms. Wade was not at home.
"Exercising," she said. "Gold's Gym, on Union."
I found the gym around the corner between a Starbucks and an Alfredson's Market. At reception, a buffed ponytailed staffer informed me that Joanna was in exercise room C. When I asked what Joanna Wade looked like, the staffer laughed.
"Think blonde and kick-ass fit."
I wandered in, and through a large observation window, spotted a Tae Bo class in exercise room C. About 8 women, sweating in lycra and jog bras, were kicking their legs out karate style to loud music. I knew that Tae Bo was the latest exercise craze, the biggest burn. Any one of these women looked as if she could take a resisting suspect up against a wall, then beat the patrol car back to the precinct with breath to spare. The only blonde was in front. Trim, sculpted, pushing herself hard and barely breaking a sweat. It was her class. I hung around until she finished up and most of the class had rushed out. She toweled the sweat off her face. "Great workout," I said as she headed my way.
"The best in the Bay Area. Looking to sign up?"
"Maybe. First I thought I could ask you a couple of questions." "Try Diane up front. She can tell you the whole deal." "I wasn't talking Tae Bo." I flashed her my badge. "I'm talking Nicholas Jenks." Joanna stared at me, flapping her blonde ponytail off her shoulders to cool her neck. She smirked.
"What'd he do, get caught shoplifting one of his books out of Stacy's downtown?"
"Can we talk?" I asked. She shrugged and led me over to a changing area that was unoccupied.
"So what could I tell you about Nick that you couldn't find out from one of his jacket flaps?"
"I know it was several years ago," I said, "but you once filed a domestic complaint against him."
"Listen, in case the paperwork didn't catch up, I dropped the charge back then."
I could see the terror of the moment exploding all over again for her. "Look," I said genuinely, "no one's trying to dig up old wounds, Miss Wade. I'd just like a read on your ex-husband."
"Up to his old tricks again?"
I could see her sizing me up. Was I an ally or a foe? Then she let out a capitulating breath and looked right at me. "If you're here about Chessie..." I could have warned her. "If he hadn't been such a creep about how he dumped me. How did he put it?"
"I write through her, Joe. She inspires me."
"You ever read his books, Inspector?" she asked. "She didn't have to inspire him by holding a job down while he went off and found himself, did she? She didn't have to read his drafts, deal with his rages when he got rejected, tell him every night how much she believed in him. You know where he met her? In the makeup room at Entertainment Tonight."
"What I'm asking, Miss Wade," I said, "is how violent is Nicholas Jenks?"
She paused, looked away. When she turned back, her eyes had filled up as if she were about to cry. "You know, you come in here after all this time and make me go through this again. What do you want me to say? That his mother didn't love him? That he's a screwed-up, dangerous man? Life with Nick, it's so hard. He's holding something in, and God only knows when it's going to come out. I would ask myself, why? What had I done? I was just a kid." Her eyes glistened. "I'm sorry." I truly felt for her, for both Mrs. Jenks's. I couldn't even imagine what it was like to wake up and find myself married to someone like him. "I need to ask," I said, "what are the chances things with your ex-husband have intensified, become more serious?" She looked stunned. "Is Chessie all right, Inspector?"
"Chessie's all right," I nodded, making it clear I felt there were others who might not be.
She waited for me to blink. When I didn't, she gave me a mirthless laugh.
"So, I guess we're talking a lot deeper than pilfering a book from Stacy's bookstore?"
I nodded again. Woman to woman now, I said, "I need to ask you a crucial question, Miss Wade." Chapter 79.
What I asked Joanna Wade was whether Nicholas Jenks was capable of murder.
I couldn't tell her the reason, but it didn't matter. Joanna was a quick study. I saw the shock in her eyes. After she calmed, I watched her go through a thoughtful evaluation. Finally, she looked at me and asked again, "Have you ever read his books, Inspector?"
"One. Fatal Charm. Tough book."
"He lives with those characters, Inspector. Sometimes I think he forgets it's only what he does for a living."
I saw the self-judging look in her eyes. I leaned in closer.
"I don't mean to hurt you, but I have to know. Could he kill? Is he capable of murder? I know he's capable of completely debasing another human being. That's murder, isn't it? He's what they call a sexual sadist. His father used to beat his mother in their bedroom closet as an aphrodisiac. He preys on weakness. Yes, the famous Nicholas Jenks humiliated me. But let me tell you the worst thing, the very worst. He left me, Inspector. I didn't leave him."
Joanna leaned back and gave me sort of a compassionate smile. "I've seen Chessie around a few times. Luncheons, benefits. We've even spoken a bit. He hasn't changed. She knows I know exactly what she's going through. But it's something we can't share. I see the fear. I know how it is. When she looks in the mirror, she no longer recognizes the person she once was." My blood was at the boiling point. Through the tough veneer, I saw a glimpse of the woman Joanna Wade had been. Young, needing, confused. I reached out and touched her hand. I had my answer. I closed my pad, ready to get up, when Joanna surprised me.
"I thought it was him. Not really. But I thought of Nick when I heard about those terrible crimes. I thought about his book, and I said, it could be him."
I stopped Joanna.
"What book?"
"The first thing he wrote. Always a Bridesmaid. I figured that's what brought you here, what connected him to the murders."
I stared at her, confused.
"Just what are you talking about?"
"I barely remember it. He wrote it before we met. I was lucky enough to come in for the second unpublished one, which I'm told he recently sold for $2 million. But this book I'd totally forgotten about until recently. It was about a student in law school who discovers his wife with his best friend. He kills them both, ends up going on a rampage."
"What kind of rampage?" I asked.
What she said next made me gasp. "He goes around killing brides and grooms. A lot like what happened."
Chapter 80. That was the piece of the puzzle I needed. If Jenks had premeditated these crimes, mapped them out in some early book, it would constitute unimpeachable knowledge, no longer circumstantial. With everything else we had, I could definitely bring him in.
"Where can I find this book?" I asked.
"It wasn't very good," Joanna Wade replied. "Never published." Every nerve in my body was standing on end. "Do you have a copy?"
"Trust me. If I did, I would have burned it years ago. Nick had this agent in town, Greg Marks. He dumped him when he got successful. If anyone would have it, it might be him."
I called Greg Marks from the car. I was really humming now. I loved this. The operator connected me, and after four rings, an answering tape came on.
"You've reached Greg Marks Associates."
I cringed with disappointment.
"Damn, damn, damn."
Reluctantly, I left him my pager number.
"A matter of great urgency," I said.
I was about to tell him why I was calling when a voice cut in on the tape.
"This is Greg Marks."
I explained I needed to see him immediately. His office wasn't too far. I could be there in 10 minutes.
"I have an engagement at One Market at 6:15, the agent replied curtly, "but if you can get here..."
"You just stay right there," I told him. "This is police business, and it's important. If you leave, I'll arrest you."
Greg Marks worked out of his brownstone, a third-floor loft in Pacific Heights, with a partial view of the bridge. He answered the door with a suspicious reserve. He was short, balding, smartly dressed, a jacquard shirt buttoned to the top.
"I'm afraid you haven't picked a popular topic with me, Inspector. Nicholas Jenks hasn't been a client for over 6 years. He left me the day Crossed Wire hit the Chronicle's bestseller list.
Are you still in touch? I wanted to make sure anything I asked him wouldn't get back to Jenks.
Why? To remind him how I babysat him through the years when he could barely use a noun with an adjective? How I took his obsessed midnight calls, stroked that gigantic ego?
I'm here about something Jenks wrote early on, I interrupted, before any big deals. I spoke to his ex-wife.
Joanna?
Marks exclaimed with surprise. She said he had written a book that never got published. She thought it was called Always a Bridesmaid. The agent nodded.
It was an uneven first effort, no real narrative power. Truth is, I never even sent it out.
Do you have a copy?
Packed it back to him as soon as I turned the final page. I would think Jenks must, though. He thought the book was a suspense masterpiece.
I was hoping I wouldn't have to go through him, I said, without conveying the basis of my interest. I leaned forward. How do I get my hands on a copy of that novel without going to Jenks directly?
Joanna didn't save it? Marks rubbed a finger across his temple. Jenks was always paranoid about people ripping him off. Maybe he had it copyrighted. Why don't you check into that?
I needed to run this by someone. I needed to run it by the girls.
Do you want to hear something really scary about Jenks? The agent said then.
Please, go ahead.
Here's the idea for a book he always wanted to write. It's about a novelist who is obsessed, the kind of thing Stephen King does so well. In order to write a better book, a great book, he actually murders people to see what it's like. Welcome to the horrible mind of Nicholas Jenks.
Chapter 81. This was why I had become a homicide detective. I rushed back to the office, my head whirling with how to get my hands on this lost book, when the next bombshell hit. It was McBride.
Are you sitting?
He asked, as if he were about to deliver the coup de grace.
Nicholas Jenks was here in Cleveland. The night of the Hall of Fame murders. The son of a bitch was here.
Jenks had lied right to my face. He hadn't even blinked. It was now clear. The unidentifiable man at the Hall of Fame had been him after all. He had no alibi. McBride explained how his men had scoured the local hotels. Finally, they uncovered that Jenks had been at the Westin, and amazingly, he had registered under his own name. A desk clerk working there that night remembered him. She knew it the minute she saw Jenks. She was a fan. My mind raced with the ramifications. This was all McBride needed. They had a prior relationship with the victim, a possible sighting at the scene. Now Jenks was placed in his town. He had even lied under questioning.
Tomorrow I'm going to the district attorney for an indictment, McBride announced. As soon as we have it, I want you to pick Nicholas Jenks up.
The truth hit me like a sledgehammer. We could lose him to Cleveland. All the evidence, all those right hunches, wouldn't help us. Now we might only be able to tag on a concurrent life sentence at a second trial. The Brants and the Wiles, the DeGeorges and the Passanos would be crushed. Mercer would go ballistic. I was left with an absolutely demoralizing choice. Either pick Jenks up and hold him for McBride, or make our move now with less than an airtight case. I should run this up the ladder, the voice sounded in my head. But the voice in my heart said, run it by the girls. Chapter 82. I got them together on an hour's notice. Cleveland's ready to indict, I told them. Then I dropped the bombshell about the book Always a Bridesmaid.
You've got to find it, Jill declared. It's the one link we can tie into all three crimes. Given that it was unpublished, it's as good as exclusive knowledge of the killings. It might even parallel the actual crimes. You find that book, Lindsay, we put Jenks behind bars. Forever.
How? Joanna Wade mentioned a prior agent, and I went to see him.
Nada. He said check out the Office of Copyrights. Where is that?
Cindy shook her head.
Washington, I think.
That'll take days, or more. We don't have days. I turned to Jill. Maybe it's time for a search warrant. Blow in on Jenks.
We need the gun and the book, and we need them now.
We do that, Jill said nervously, we might bungle this whole investigation.
Jill, you want to lose him?
Anyone know about this yet?
She asked. I shook my head. Just the first team.